And welcome to Focus on the Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with me today, Sean Kelly, Senior Vice President and Director of Interpretation for Eastern State Penitentiary Historic Site. I stumbled over the word state, not penitentiary.
It's a long title. I've been fighting with it for years. It's great to be back. Thank you.
But the wonderful thing is, due to your establishment, we both know how to spell penitentiary now. I'd never looked at it before as penitent.
Yes, that's the root of the word. I hadn't either until I took this job. But penitentiary is a type of prison that makes someone, it's meant anyway, it's intended to make someone feel sorry, remorseful, or penitent. And Eastern State is the world's first. Of course, today we use that term for any kind of prison. All the federal prisons are called penitentiaries, but it has its roots in this history where a group of Philadelphians said, let's make a new kind of prison that makes people genuinely sorry for what they did, and we'll make up a new word for it. We're going to call it a penitentiary, a building designed to inspire penitence or remorse.
Before Eastern State, what was the prison system like, or how did we punish an offender?
Before Eastern State, there almost was no prison system. I mean, prisons tended to be places that were where they put people while they were figuring out what to do with them, but the idea of time as punishment was new, brand new with Eastern State, and a few other prisons of its era started saying the punishment will be time, but they were not in the business of putting people in prison for years on end before Eastern State Penitentiary. They were, prisons were large open holding cells. They would put everybody in together, and as they figured out what kind of financial or physical punishment they might give a person, or even like, exiling them out of the country or whatever kind of punishment they were going to give them, it wasn't going to require years and years and years of putting someone inside of a prison.
So we went from punishing somebody for a deed they did to making them sorry and restoring their soul or their sense of citizenship.
That's what they were trying to do. I mean, they really believed that people are good. They believe this is the early generation of prison reformers here in Philadelphia, believe that people are good and believed that they could change. And so while the punishment that they came up with today, or the treatment that they came up with today, is used as punishment with solitary confinement, but they believed this would help people, make them better people. And so they put every man, woman, and child into solitary confinement for years on end with the belief, they were inspired by the Quakers, among others, with the belief that people would spend that time, they would look into their hearts, and they would become penitent, that they would return to their natural sense of right and wrong. And so the people who built Eastern State Penitentiary designed the entire prison for solitary confinement. They didn't call it that, but that's what we would call it today. And it was extremely expensive and cumbersome to try to build a prison with the technology available in the 1820s. And this is like not long after the American Revolution. And they're putting flush toilets and central heat into this massive prison to put people away for years alone, with the belief that that would be the best for their character. They knew it would be a hard experience. Even then, they knew that solitary confinement was not a very natural state for us. But they believed people would spend that time looking to their hearts and become penitent. And I will say they failed spectacularly, except for one thing, which is they convinced the world that we should be talking about how to rehabilitate people who are in prison, how to treat people in prison with dignity, how to think about what comes next, and think about, okay, this person is going to be in prison for this certain amount of time. Let's start planning for what happens when they leave. These were all brand new conversations. And the building is built with this profound sense of optimism that people are good and they can change. But that system, solitary confinement, years on end, is today exactly what we do to punish people. It's a very effective punishment. And they had no idea what effect they were going to have on people. And we know now that it was terrible, just terrible.
So it influenced the world with the idea of rehabilitation, but it also architecturally influenced the world, and you still see Eastern State penitentiaries.
That's exactly right. We estimate there are about 300 buildings modeled after Eastern State, usually in the mid-1800s. Eastern State's the early 1800s. People came to Philadelphia. They made drawings. We have all these drawings. People came and they measured the cells and they measured the corridors and they went back. and they copied it. And so most European prisons looked like Eastern State Penitentiary. So the big competing model of prison design was out of New York, and that was Sing Sing. And so most American prisons looked like Sing Sing, and most European prisons and prisons in European colonies looked like Eastern State Penitentiary. It was called the Pennsylvania System. And if you look at those buildings from above, they look like a star. And you can stand in the middle and look down each one of those corridors. They call it a wagon wheel or a hub and spoke. And you can stand in the middle and look down each corridor. And that room in the middle is the equivalent of today. If you go to a prison, you'd see someone sitting in a room looking at a whole wall of video monitors. For that matter, if you went to a shopping mall, you'd see the same thing. That is the control point where one person can see everything. And that's what the floor plan of Eastern State Penitentiary allowed. One person stands in the middle and they can see, in theory, they can see everything. And so that's the system that got copied all over Europe. If you look at European cities from above, you can pick them out a mile away. There's a giant building shaped like a star. And that's the prison built on, modeled after Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia.
So we impressed the architects, but yet other great thinkers, intellectuals, and visitors to the city were absolutely appalled by what we were doing.
Yes. I mean, there were people even from the earliest years who said solitary confinement is a bad idea. And the most famous was Charles Dickens. The building was famous. It was being copied all over the world. And Charles Dickens, when he visited the United States to write a book about the United States, he devoted it an entire chapter to Eastern State Penitentiary. He said before he left England that the things he wanted to see most in the United States were Niagara Falls and the Eastern State Penitentiary. He came and he interviewed some of the people who were incarcerated, which, of course, they were supposed to be in solitary confinement, but he got special permission to talk to some of the people who were incarcerated. He talked to some of the staff. He went back. He said that, as I was started off by saying, he recognized this was a step forward in this attitude. So he said, the people running this are good people. They have the best interest in mind of the people who are incarcerated. And then he went on to say, they have no idea what they're doing. The outside of the prison looks like a castle and the inside looks like a church. And Charles Dickens said they should have just gone ahead and built a castle on the inside too. You know, the outside of the building makes you think of dungeons and torture chambers. It's got battlement walls and arrow slit windows and a portcullis. And there's all this fortress architecture that implies that on the inside you'd find a dungeon, you know, torture chambers and all that stuff, because that's what they thought would deter crime. Charles Dickens said they should have just done it. They should have just gone ahead and built physical torture chambers rather than trying to affect the way that people think. I'll give you the full Charles Dickens quote. Here goes, I hold this slow and daily tampering with the mysteries of the brain to be immeasurably worse than any torture of the body. So that's something that's still debated in the way prisons are run today, you know.
So they go from the idea of rehabilitation and a plan, getting them ready for a release into society where they will be welcomed back and good citizens and able to support themselves, et cetera. We go from this wonderful idea and a bad implementation of it. But then slowly, Eastern State becomes a warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
And it falls into, well, it's finally decommissioned.
Right.
It falls into disrepair. It's finally resurrected. It goes into a state of preservation and restoration. Mm-hmm. And now today, do you want to talk a little bit about how you shift from that to its current mission?
Sure. Well, as you say, the prison, that revolutionary system that was copied all over the world, fell out of favor. And as you say, the prison just became a typical prison where they were warehousing people for the most part. All through the 20th century, it didn't close until 1971. So there are still people alive. There's still people incarcerated in Pennsylvania who were held at Eastern State Penitentiary. Of course, fewer every year, but there's still a handful of people left. And so it survived through most of American history. You know, it closed in 1971. The city of Philadelphia planned to tear it down. Actually, originally they planned to make it into a prison again. They found it was cheaper to build a new prison than to keep messing with this old one. Prison was 142 years old the year that it closed. So, the state got its money's worth out of that investment. But the city of Philadelphia purchased it. They planned to tear it down. They found that tearing it down was actually prohibitively expensive because of the density of the construction. You know, these stone walls every 10 feet throughout 10 acres of property. It's like a rock quarry. And so it didn't make sense financially to tear the building down. And there was just sort of this prolonged 15 years of people scratching their heads and saying, what do we do with this thing? A group of preservationists, for the most part, and some criminologists advocated for a museum. And that museum opened in 1994. It opened with very little fanfare. I'm really proud of our long history of just letting the building be interesting and just letting it be itself. And so we don't We haven't filled it with holograms and, you know, big flashy exhibits. And we've really just, people love to explore that building. It is so beautiful. It has arched ceilings and sunlight, and it's just incredibly photogenic. And we just try to kind of keep out of the way. We hire extremely good educators, we've built a couple of exhibits I'm very proud of. But for the most part, we just let the building be the building. We opened it in 1994. Our attendance has been growing and growing and growing and growing. I think today we're the number five most visited site in Philadelphia. Proud to say that we have the highest ranking on TripAdvisor for visitors. I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't say that. I'm very, very proud of that. But we're consistently number one in terms of visitor satisfaction for a visit on TripAdvisor. And we just let the building be the building, you know. And for the longest time, well, for 15 years, we talked about the history of the building exclusively. You know, we talked about why the building was built, kind of like we have here this morning. You know, why the building was built, who built it, what went wrong, why it changed, how it closed. There was a lot to talk about, how it influenced other buildings. Starting about 10 years ago, though, we started saying, you know, we're in this truly historic moment, and it's hard to see it because we're in it. But we put a lot more people in prison per capita, you know, than we ever did before, by a long shot. And no other country's doing this, no other generations of Americans have done this. And it's really noteworthy that, you know, we have put 3.5 times more people in prison per capita than we did in 1970. And, you know, what have we gotten for that investment? And what have we gotten for, you know, that's obviously a very hard experience for the people going through it. And it costs a lot of money. And are we safer now than we were in 1971? We're not, statistically, you know. And so what do we get out of this? And we found that there are a lot of people on many sides of this debate that all were coming to the same conclusion, that it's time to really talk about why we put so many people in prison and what are we getting out of it. And so about 10 years ago, we started saying, like, to connect the dots, to say, like, that was then. How have things changed now? What are we doing now that's different? And I've never been incarcerated. I've never even been arrested. But we began to really look for advisors and some coworkers even who could help kind of flesh out what that experience is like, and began making some exhibits and hiring people who could talk about the American prison system today and how it's different, how its legacy is in these old prisons like Eastern State, but how is it different? And we've been having a lot of luck talking to our visitors really making the building, if visitors choose to, they don't have to, but if they want to have a conversation about how the prisons have changed and what's happening today, we've built the tools and hired the staff that we can have that conversation for those who want to have it. So.
No, it is a lot. And you can go through and you can see these cells, but then you have the exhibits that ask the questions and get you thinking about what would you do?
Mm-hmm.
What is your sense of justice? It looks at race as well.
Mm-hmm. It looks at all those things. And we spend a lot of time thinking about trying to meet our visitors where they are. And, you know, a lot of our visitors are actually tourists on vacation, and no one wants to be lectured about this stuff. And we find that our visitors often have really interesting experiences themselves. And so our staff and our exhibits try to make a lot of space for our visitors' perspectives. And everyone has their own personal truth for how they feel about these things. And we don't put anyone on the spot. We don't force people to talk about it. We don't lecture them. But we do show some, for instance, we have a graph. We have a 16-foot graph that shows the rate of incarceration in U.S. history per capita. And you see this low line, and then it just spikes up to 16 feet. So in our baseball diamond. And you walk out there, you look at it, you say, wow, what is so different today than it was 30 years ago that we're putting this many more people in prison? And that's kind of where we leave it. You know, we ask our visitors to reflect on it, and if they choose to.
Reflection.
And, you know, they can look at that and make what they will of it. And you see a lot of cell phones come out. The edge of that graph shows all the nations of the world and their per capita percentage of people they put in prison. And you see that all the American allies have like 1/5 or 1/4 of the percentage of people in prison that we do. And we just, you know, we don't feel it's our place to really start lecturing people about why. In fact, there's a lot of debate about why that is. But just showing people this is what's happening. If they want to, they can follow up on it. And our staff is wonderful. We have fantastic educators who really respect our visitors and spend a lot of time listening. And just, you know, there's some theories about why that is. And we can talk about it if they want. But you see the cell phones come out there a lot and photographing, you know, where the United States is compared to all of our allies and how many more people we put in prison than anyone everyone else.
The graph is striking, and it's an award-winning graph, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a great installation. And speaking of installation, you also tell the story of the prisoners themselves, mm-hmm. or people who are experiencing incarceration today. And you do it through art. And again, they're not intrusive, but they are thought-provoking and quite striking and sometimes beautiful.
I'm so glad you said that. We're really proud of our art program. Artists have a way of really being able to cut through conversations and speak from personal experience. So we have some wonderful installations. Our most current installation is on death row, and it's a sound installation by an artist named Mark Menjivar. Our death row has never been open to the public before. You could walk through a little access corridor and see into it, but we actually opened up the cells. You can step into the cells inside of death row now. And then Mark has installed a sound installation. It's a piece of music written by a man on Texas death row, and it's very eerie, and it plays now inside of, and that man was eventually executed, and it plays now inside of our death row. And it's just a wonderful, troubling way to sort of bring some humanity back into the space. It's also just very eerie and sort of evocative, and we're very proud of it. But, you know, there is a lot to be said about violence and the experience of gun violence here in our city and the need for some kind of law enforcement reaction. I'm a native Philadelphian, and I'm horrified by all the gun violence, too. And we are certainly not saying that there doesn't need to be consequences for violence. We're certainly not saying that victims' voices aren't really important to listen to as well. We have a wonderful exhibit by Cindy Stockton Moore that's the faces of men, women, and children. I'm sorry, this is such a dark conversation. I didn't mean for it to go quite this dark, but Cindy's made this piece that's the faces of men, women, and children who were murdered, and the murderers eventually became incarcerated at Eastern State Penitentiary. So these are kind of the backstories explaining why some of the people who were incarcerated at Eastern State were there in the first place. It's the faces of the people whose murder led to their conviction. So we try to tell a complicated story. We try to do a lot of listening. We're not into simple answers. We're not advocates. We're not out there saying people should vote a certain way or another. But we think, you know, a lot of our visitors welcome the chance to get a little closer to these issues, hear some of the voices while they're in the midst of this extraordinarily beautiful architectural space with this really fascinating history that kind of try to round that experience out.
And there's nothing simple about this entire conversation.
No, there's not.
Speaking of the art, though, I know that you went into the prisons and worked with those incarcerated to work on a video project a few years ago. Uh-huh. You know, COVID has completely screwed up my sense of time when things happened. Those 2 years
Mine
disappeared
too.
Completely.
Mine
but
too.
You did that. So you worked with actual prisoners on projects. You work with artists and the public going mm-hmm. back to the opposite direction away. You have letters and there are all kinds of programs that have interaction mm-hmm. between those incarcerated and those not. But then you also have your program with the Preservation Trade Center, getting back to your original mission when it opened in 1820.
I'm so proud of this. Yes, we have a program that's gone back now a couple of years. Our education department started seeking out people who had been incarcerated. Not all of our educators are formally incarcerated. We have a few people on the team at any given moment who can speak from firsthand experience about having gone to prison if they choose to. And so that's a program that goes back to 2016. Our preservation arm, under the leadership of my colleague Liz Trumbull, began looking at the preservation trades, because we hire people to work on Eastern State. The building's been abandoned for years. We always have some conservation or preservation program or another going on. And Liz really and other people in our teams began looking at that and saying, you know, why aren't there more people coming into the building trades who look more like our city? You know, the building trades historically, they've made a lot of progress recently, but historically have been really just sort of white men, many of whom have relatives and those, you know, who are sort of generationally attached to these trades. And there's nothing wrong with that at all. And we really embrace people who have these family histories. But we tried to find a way to get more people of color, people who've been incarcerated, coming home from prison, trying to make meaning out of their lives. You know, our country is really not great at helping people coming home from prison make the next chapter you know, we're trying to turn people from a tax burden into taxpayers. You know, we're trying to get people to come home and, you know, be able to buy property and start a family and all those things. And we're getting better as a society, but we still make it pretty tough. And so we're trying to see, like, why can't people come home from prison and enter the building trades? And maybe just a little bit of effort on our part can help smooth that transition and get people into these trades, which are wonderful, wonderful places to really have a career. And so these aren't huge numbers, but, you know, we've had 4 or 5 people every summer go into the union apprenticeship programs with very non-traditional backgrounds. And, you know, they have to take it from there, but we get them ready for those apprenticeship programs. We get them, they work with the union for a couple of weeks at Eastern State, getting ready for the apprenticeship program and doing work on our building, which is, God knows we need it. It's a real fixer-upper. The building's been abandoned for many years. And so they get ready, and then we help smooth that transition into the union apprenticeship programs. I'm enormously proud of it. It's so great. It's really cool.
Well, you're just sliding right into our next area of conversation. preservation, restoration, but it is crumbling, and you got to keep it safe, and you have mm-hmm. to keep it secure so it doesn't go any further into disrepair. You've done some wonderful job in restoring certain areas, though, the synagogue, for instance, and it's fun. I know it's not restored, but the operating theater, all these great things. So you're still working on all of these things, and it takes money to keep this sucker at status quo, even not above and beyond opening up new areas of it. And that takes a lot of money to fund something like this. And it is a nonprofit. And so now you've got Halloween nights. And how does this fit with your operating mission, the one that you do Monday through Sunday? You're open every day of the year except, 4 days?
Yeah,
Christmas, Thanksgiving, New Year's Day, and I think there's one other. What's the other one?
Christmas Eve. Yeah.
Here you got this fun thing going on.
We have been celebrating Halloween at Eastern State Penitentiary for 30 years. The event has evolved. It continues to evolve. It, at its core has always been, though, a real love of Halloween and a celebration of this time of the year. And, you know, it for a long time was called Terror Behind the Walls. We've changed the name now to Halloween Nights. But the best DNA from Terror Behind the Walls is still there. You know, we still have 5 haunted houses inside the building. We have expanded the event to be a festival style. And so people can wander at their own pace. If anyone has been to Terror Behind the Walls, you remember you pretty much were just forced to go through in one long line and you wound up back on the sidewalk. It's not like that. Now people can stop. We have a beer garden. We actually have 3 different bars inside the building. We have 4 different vendors selling food, and people make an entire evening of it, you know, and so you can stop at these haunted houses. And then the haunted houses are wonderful and super high-end. We are always named in the top 10 haunted houses in America, and we are going to defend that position. We are second to none in the quality of our haunted experiences. That festival style, though, has also allowed us to do some things that are close to our mission, and so that was the reason for the change. So for starters, we work with vendors who are fair chance employers, just like we are. In other words, they hire people coming home from prison, and so the event creates a lot of living wage jobs for people who have experienced incarceration. Very close to my heart, we've taken our 4 most popular daytime museum experiences and made them available at night. And so our audio tour, with narrated by Steve Buscemi from Boardwalk Empire, he came back into the studio and recorded a new version of it just for the Halloween Nights audience. So it's a little shorter, and it's a little more dramatic. You know, it has very dark and dramatic lighting, but it covers all the same material that our daytime audio tour covers. We wanted to give our educators a chance to talk directly to our visitors. And so for night tours, they give tours of our hospital, including that operating room that you were just mentioning, Laura, which is not restored, but is stabilized. And even that's expensive, just to make sure that the walls aren't going to continue to deteriorate. But it is eerie, as you can imagine, but also gives our educators a chance to talk with our visitors about the building's history. And then our mass incarceration exhibit, it's called Prisons Today, is also open at night. And so people coming at night, not everyone wants to, but it's also, all of that is centered around a beer garden. It's run by our friends at Triple Bottom Brewing, a proud Fair Chance employer like us. And so if you want to take a break from the scares in the beer garden, give yourself a little bit of a break, get your heartbeat going a little slower, blood pressure down, drink one of the delicious beers from Triple Bottom, and go see one of these daytime experiences and just take a break. You can you know, maybe a quarter or a third of our visitors take advantage of that, and we don't have any. You know, if that's not for you, that is completely fine. But then, as you say, this also is a larger source of revenue for us. And so for us, it's hitting everything. It's supporting the preservation efforts. It's supporting that Preservation Trade Academy, Preservation Trade Center, I should say. It's allowing people to experience our mission-based programs. It's creating jobs, living wage jobs for people who have experienced incarceration. It's doing it all. We have never been more proud of our Halloween event. And for those who haven't been in a couple of years, I really recommend it. It is just, I went through it just Friday night, and it was just, it has never been better. It's just a ton of fun.
Who should be coming to it? Now, by that I mean, in daytime, all ages can come in. What about the evening, the Halloween nights? And are you handicap accessible?
We are. We are handicap accessible with some slight exceptions here and there, but not really. We are, the building is almost 200 years old. It wasn't designed with these kind of modern considerations. Our staff is phenomenal. And we've, you know, at every point in the building have brainstorms about how can we make this accessible. So people come through Halloween nights and the daytime tour in wheelchairs every day. And there's always a wheelchair or two coming through every night, or a person in a wheelchair. There's always people coming through with low vision or no vision, people who are who are deaf come through all the time. We spend a lot of time thinking about how to accommodate people with various needs. And so I encourage people. We have a whole page of our website devoted to accessibility. And our experience has been that there's one or two things. There's like a flight of stairs that leads into part of the building that you just, it will never be handicap accessible. And so, you know, we build workarounds and find ways that we can show people what those experiences are like. But our experience has been that we have our heart in this. We are really trying to accommodate people with different abilities. And people really can feel that when they come. And if there's maybe one thing they can't get to, one flight of stairs that just is not, it was built in 1820. It's super steep. You know, there's no way to get a ramp down it. It just, it's never going to happen. But it's, that is, almost nothing on the properties is truly inaccessible.
What about age groups? And this includes mm-hmm. the daytime tours as well. Who, at what age?
We don't recommend the day tour for kids under 7, only because the building is so is just so old, you know, and so the stairs are steep, you know, or the, you know, the floors are uneven. And so kids running around sometimes make us nervous. And there isn't programming for kids under 7. So we don't claim that we've made anything that's really going to be engaging for like toddlers inside the building during the day. And at night, we don't recommend it for kids under 10 because well, there are lots of kids who are 12, 14 years old having a ball inside of that place. The haunted houses are no joke. The 500 houses are scary, and we're not playing around. They're scary. They're not themed, by the way, like prisons, you know, but there's a new one that's themed like a carnival, and it is really, really creepy. So depending on your 12-year-old, you know, they may or may not be ready for that, but it's we don't recommend it for kids under 10.
Well, my inner 12-year-old can't wait. I always enjoyed coming, and I'm so glad that you were able to come up with a way that highlighted the mission and at the same time brings in the revenue. Can't beat that. But you know what? Parting words, we're at the end.
Oh, well, I can't leave without saying happy Halloween. And I'm a native Philadelphian. Philadelphia's been so good to Eastern State Penitentiary. If you haven't been in a while, I hope you'll come out and see it. We are a true Philadelphia success story. We are growing and growing and growing. And we're just so proud that we've been able to attract so many of our people in the region and people who want to come out and see this abandoned building. And if you're into Instagram or social media, man, it is nothing in the world like standing in cell block 7 of Eastern State Penitentiary, the 30-foot barrel vaulted ceiling and columns of sunlight coming down behind you. It's like it's just extraordinary how photogenic that building is.
And how do we follow you on social media?
We are on all of the social medias, and I honestly don't remember all the hashtags, but we our social media team is doing a great job. We just launched our TikTok a couple of months ago.
TikTok.
TikTok. Yeah, our TikTok a couple of weeks ago. And of course, we have our Instagram feed is fascinating and really great, and Facebook and all of those things.
Well, of course, learn about the mission, learn about the tours and how you can visit, learn how you can support them. You can become a member.
Please.
All of that is available at easternstate.org. That's easternstate.org. Halloween nights tickets available at that site as well?
Yes, they are. And you can also take a virtual tour on our website. So it's a really lovely, very detailed virtual tour if you want to get a sense of what the inside of the building looks like. And Halloween nights open through November 12th.
easternstate.org. My guest today, the Senior Vice President and Director of Interpretation, Sean Kelly. Sean, thanks for coming back.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Laura.
Anytime. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been Focus on the Delaware Valley.